all items in the same category from drawers, closets, and cupboards and spreading them out on the floor. Things stored out of sight are dormant. This makes it much harder to decide whether they inspire joy or not. By exposing them to the light of day and jolting them alive, so to speak, you'll find it surprisingly easy to judge whether they touch your heart. Dealing with just one category within a single time frame speeds up the tidying process. So be sure to gather every item in the category you are working on. Don't let any slip by unnoticed. Starting with mementos spells certain failure. You launch into your day all fired up to tidy. But before you know it, the sun is setting and you've barely made a dent in your belongings. Noticing the time with a start, you feel yourself sinking into self-reproach and despair. And what are you holding in your hands? More often than not, it's one of your favorite comic books, an album, or some other item that brings back fond memories. My advice to begin tidying not by room but by category does not mean that you should start with any category you like. The degree of difficulty involved in selecting what to keep and what to discard differs greatly depending on the category. People who get stuck halfway usually do so because they start with the things that are hardest to make decisions about. Things that bring back memories, such as photos, are not the place for beginners to start. Not only is the sheer volume of items in this category usually greater than that of any other, but it is also far harder to make a decision about whether or not to keep them. In addition to the physical value of things, there are three other factors that add value to our belongings: function, information, and emotional attachment. When the element of rarity is added, the difficulty in choosing what to discard multiplies. People have trouble discarding things that they could still use, functional value, that contain helpful information, informational value, and that have sentimental ties, emotional value. When these things are hard to obtain or replace, rarity, they become even harder to part with. The process of deciding what to keep and what to discard will go much more smoothly if you begin with items that are easier to make decisions about. As you gradually work toward the harder categories, you will be honing your decision-making skills. Clothes are the easiest because their rarity value is extremely low. Photographs and letters, on the other hand, not only have a high sentimental value but are also one of a kind. Therefore, they should be left until last. This is true for photographs in particular, because they tend to turn up at random while sorting through other categories and in the most unexpected places, such as between books and papers. The best sequence is this: clothes first, then books, papers, kimono, miscellany, and lastly, mementos. This order has also proven to be the most efficient in terms of the level of difficulty for the subsequent task of storing. Finally, sticking to this sequence sharpens our intuitive sense of what items spark joy inside us. If you can dramatically accelerate the speed of the decision-making process just by changing the order in which you discard, don't you think it's worth a try? Don't let your family see. Marathon tidying produces a heap of garbage. At this stage, the one disaster that can wreak more havoc than an earthquake is the entrance of that recycling expert who goes by the alias of Mother. One of my clients, whom I'll call M, lived with her parents and one sibling. They had moved to the house 15 years earlier when M was still in grade school. Not only did she love buying clothes, but she also saved those that had sentimental value, such as school uniforms and t-shirts made for various events. She stored these in boxes and stacked them on the floor until the floorboards were completely obscured from view. It took 5 hours to sort and clean. By the end of that day, she had 15 bags to get rid of, including 8 bags of clothes, 200 books, various stuffed toys, and crafts she had made at school. We had stacked everything neatly beside the door on the floor, which was now finally visible, and I was just about to explain a very important point. "There's one secret you should know about getting rid of this garbage," I began, when the door opened and in came her mother bearing a tray of iced tea. "Oh dear," I thought. Her mother set down the tray on a table. "Thank you so much for helping my daughter," she said, and turned to leave. At that moment, Her eyes fell on the pile of garbage by the door. "Oh, my! Are you going to throw that away?" she said, pointing to a pink yoga mat on top of the pile. "I haven't used it in 2 years."
"Really? Well, maybe I'll use it then."
She began rummaging through the bags.
"Oh, and maybe this, too."
When she left, she took not only the yoga mat, but also 3 skirts, 2 blouses, 2 jackets, and some stationery. When the room was quiet again, I sipped my iced tea and asked Em, "So how often does your mother do yoga?"
"I've never seen her do any."
What I had been about to say before her mother came in was this:
"Don't let your family see what's here. If at all possible, take the bags out yourself.
There's no need to let your family know the details of what you throw out or donate. I especially recommend that my clients avoid showing their parents. It's not that there is anything to be ashamed of. There's nothing wrong with tidying. However, it's extremely stressful for parents to see what their children discard. The sheer volume of the pile can make parents anxious about whether their children can survive on what's left. In addition, despite knowing that they should rejoice at their child's independence and maturity, parents can find it very painful to see clothes, toys, and mementos from the past on the rubbish heap, especially if they are things they gave to their child. Keeping your garbage out of sight is considerate. It also protects your family from acquiring more than they need or can enjoy. Up to this point, your family was perfectly content with what they had. When they see what you have chosen to discard, they may feel guilty at such blatant waste, but the items they retrieve from your pile just increase the burden of unnecessary items in their home. And we should be ashamed of forcing them to carry this burden. In an overwhelming percentage of cases, it is the mother who retrieves things from her daughter. Yet mothers rarely wear the clothes they take. The women I work with, who are in their 50s and 60s, invariably end up discarding or donating their daughters' hand-me-downs without ever wearing them. I think we should avoid creating situations like this where a mother's affection for her daughter becomes a burden. Of course, there's nothing wrong with other family members actually using the things you don't need. If you live with your family, you could ask them, "Is there something you need that you were planning to buy?" before you start tidying. And then if you happen to come across exactly what they need, give it to them as a gift. If you're mad at your family, your room may be the cause.
"Even if I tidy, the rest of my family just messes things up again."
"My husband's a pack rat. How can I get him to throw things away?"
It can be very annoying when your family doesn't cooperate with your attempts to achieve the ideal home. This is something I experienced many times in the past. At one time, I was so absorbed in tidying that cleaning my own room was not enough. I just had to tackle my siblings' rooms and every other space in the house, and I was constantly frustrated by my untidy family. A major cause of distress was the communal storage closet in the middle of the house. To me, more than half of it seemed to be devoted to unused and unnecessary junk. The clothing rods were jammed with outfits I had never seen my mother wear, and suits belonging to my father that were clearly obsolete. Boxes of manga belonging to my brother covered the floor. I would wait until the timing was right and confront the owner with this question: "You don't use this anymore, right?" But the response was either, "Yes, I do," or, "I'll get rid of it myself," which they never did. Every time I looked in that closet, I would sigh and complain. "Why does everyone keep accumulating things? Can't they see how hard I'm working to keep the house tidy?" Fully aware that I was an anomaly when it came to tidying, I was not going to let them defeat me. When my frustration reached the limit, I decided to adopt stealth tactics. I identified items that had not been used for many years, judging by their design, the amount of dust they had gathered, and the way they smelled. I would move those items to the very back of the closet and observe what happened. If no one noticed that they were missing, I disposed of them, one item at a time, just as if I were thinning plants. After 3 months of this strategy, I had managed to dispose of 10 bags worth. In most cases, no one noticed, and life went on as usual. But when the volume reached a certain point, people began to miss a thing or two. When they pointed the finger at me, I responded quite shamelessly. My basic strategy was to play ignorant.
Hey, do you know where my jacket went?
Nope.
If they pressed me further, my next step was denial.
Muddy, are you sure you didn't throw it out?
Yes, I'm sure.
Oh, well, I wonder where it could be then.
If they gave up at this point, my conclusion was that whatever the item had been, it hadn't been worth saving. But if they were no longer fooled, I still wasn't fazed.
I know it was here, Muddy. I saw it with my own eyes just 2 months ago.
Far from apologizing for discarding their things without permission, I would retort, I threw it out for you because you weren't capable of doing it yourself. In retrospect, I must admit that I was pretty arrogant. Once exposed, I was met with a flood of reproach and protest, and, in the end, I was forbidden to tidy anywhere but my own room. If I could, I'd go back and give myself a good smack and make sure that I didn't even consider such a ridiculous campaign. Getting rid of other people's things without permission demonstrates a sad lack of common sense. Although such stealth tactics generally succeed and the items discarded are never missed, the risk of losing your family's trust when you are caught is far too great. Besides, it just isn't right. If you really want your family to tidy up, there is a much easier way to go about it. After I was banned from tidying other people's spaces and had nowhere to turn but my own room, I took a good look around it and was struck by a surprising fact. There were far more items that needed discarding than I had noticed before. A shirt in my closet that I had never worn, along with an outdated skirt that I wouldn't wear again. Books on my shelves that I knew I didn't need. I realized with a shock that I was guilty of exactly the same thing I had been so bitterly accusing my family of doing. Not being in a position to criticize others, I sat down with my garbage bags and focused on tidying my own space. After about 2 weeks, a change began to occur in my family. My brother, who had refused, no matter how much I had complained, to get rid of anything, began a thorough sorting of his belongings. In a single day, he disposed of more than 200 books. Then my parents and my sister gradually began to sort and discard their clothes and accessories. In the end, my whole family was able to keep the house much tidier than before. To quietly work away at disposing of your own excess is actually the best way of dealing with a family that doesn't tidy. As if drawn into your wake, they will begin weeding out unnecessary belongings and tidying without your having to utter a single complaint. It may sound incredible, but when someone starts tidying, it sets off a chain reaction. Cleaning quietly on one's own generates another interesting change. The ability to tolerate a certain level of untidiness among your family members. Once I was satisfied with my own room, I no longer felt the urge to dispose of things belonging to my siblings or parents. When I noticed that communal spaces such as the living room or bathroom were messy, I cleaned them up without a second thought and never bothered to mention it. I have noticed this same change occur in many of my clients as well. If you feel annoyed with your family for being untidy, I urge you to check your own space, especially your storage. You are bound to find things that need to be thrown away. The urge to point out someone else's failure to tidy is usually a sign that you are neglecting to take care of your own space. This is why you should begin by discarding only your own things. You can leave the communal spaces to the end. The first step is to confront your own stuff. What you don't need, your family doesn't either. My sister is 3 years younger than me. Quiet and a bit on the shy side, she prefers to stay inside and draw or read quietly rather than to go out and socialize. Without a doubt, she suffered the most from my research on tidying, serving as my unsuspecting victim. By the time I was a university student, my focus was on discarding, but there were always things that I found hard to dispose of, such as a t-shirt that I really liked but that somehow didn't look right. Unable to bring myself to part with it, I would try the item on repeatedly, standing in front of the mirror, but in the end, would be forced to conclude that it just didn't suit me. If it was brand new, or a gift from my parents, the thought of getting rid of it made me feel very guilty. At times like this, my sister came in very handy. The gift for my sister method seemed the perfect way to cast off such items. When I say gift, I don't mean that I wrapped it up like a present. Far from it. With the unwanted outfit in my hand, I would barge into my sister's room where she lay on her bed reading contentedly. Extracting the book from her hand, I would say, "You want this T-shirt? I'll give it to you if you like." Seeing the puzzled look on her face, I would deal the final blow. "It's brand new and really cute, but if you don't need it, I'll have to throw it away. Are you okay with that?" My poor, mild-mannered sister would have no choice but to say, "I guess I'll take it then." This happened so frequently that my sister, who hardly ever shopped, had a closet jammed to overflowing. Although she did wear some of the clothes I gave her, there were many more that she wore only once, if ever. Yet I continued to give her presents. After all, they were good clothes, and I thought she should be happy to have more. I only realized how wrong I was after I began my consulting business and met a client whom I will call Kay. Kay was in her 20s, worked for a cosmetics company, and lived at home. As we were sorting through her clothes, I began to notice something odd about the choices she was making. Despite the fact that she owned enough clothes to fill one large closet, which is an average-size wardrobe, the number of clothes she chose to keep seemed unnaturally small. Her answer to the question, "Does this spark joy?" was almost always no. After thanking each item for a job well done, I would pass them to her to discard. I couldn't help noticing the look of relief on her face every time she put an outfit in the bag. Examining the collection more closely, I saw that the clothes she chose to keep were mostly casual things like T-shirts, while the ones she discarded were a completely different style, tight skirts and revealing tops. When I asked her about this, she said, "My older sister gave me those." When all the clothes were sorted and she had made her final choice, she murmured, "Look at that. I was surrounded by all this stuff that I didn't even like." Her sister's hand-me-downs had comprised over a third of her wardrobe, but hardly any of these had given her that important thrill of pleasure. Although she had worn them because her sister had given them to her, she had never liked them. To me, this seems tragic, and this is not an isolated case. In my work, the volume discarded by younger sisters is always greater than the volume discarded by older sisters, a phenomenon surely related to the fact that younger children are often accustomed to wearing hand-me-downs. There are two reasons why younger sisters tend to collect clothes they don't really like. One is that it's hard to get rid of something received from family. The other is that they don't really know what they like, which makes it hard to decide whether they should part with it. Because they receive so much clothing from others, they don't really need to shop, and therefore they have less opportunity to develop the instinct for what really inspires joy. Don't misunderstand me. Giving things you can't use to others who can is an excellent idea. Not only is it economical, but it can also be a source of great joy to see these things being enjoyed and treasured by someone close to you. But that is not the same as forcing things onto your family members because you can't bring yourself to discard or donate them. Whether the victim is a sibling, a parent, or a child, this particular custom should be banned. Although my sister never complained, I am sure that she must have had mixed feelings when she accepted my hand-me-downs. Basically, I was simply transferring my guilt at not being able to discard them onto her. In retrospect, that was pretty despicable. If you want to give something away, don't push people to take it unconditionally or pressure them by making them feel guilty. Find out in advance what they like, and if you find something that fits those criteria, then and only then should you show it to them. You can also offer to give it to them on the condition that it is something they would have been willing to pay for. We need to show consideration for others by helping them avoid the burden of owning more than they need or can enjoy. Tidying is a dialogue with oneself.
"Kunmari, would you like to come stand under a waterfall?"
I got this invitation from a client, a charming woman who was still an active business manager and an avid skier and hiker at the age of 74. She had been practicing meditation under running water for more than a decade and seemed to really enjoy it. She would casually remark, "I'm off to a waterfall," as if she were going to the spa. Consequently, the place she took me was not a spot for beginners on an introductory tour. Leaving our lodgings at 6 in the morning, We hiked along a mountain path, climbed over fences, and forded a river where the rushing water came up to our knees, until we finally reached a deserted waterfall. But I didn't bring up this subject because I wanted to introduce this peculiar form of recreation. Rather, I found through this experience that there is significant similarity between meditating under a waterfall and tidying. When you stand under a waterfall, the only audible sound is the roar of water. As the cascade pummels your body, the sensation of pain soon disappears and numbness spreads. Then a sensation of heat warms you from the inside out, and you enter a meditative trance. Although I had never tried this form of meditation before, the sensation it generated seemed extremely familiar. It closely resembled what I experience when I am tidying. While not exactly a meditative state, there are times when I am cleaning that I can quietly commune with myself. The work of carefully considering each object I own to see whether it sparks joy inside me is like conversing with myself through the medium of my possessions. For this reason, it is essential to create a quiet space in which to evaluate the things in your life. Ideally, you should not even be listening to music. Sometimes I hear of methods that recommend tidying in time to a catchy song, but personally, I don't encourage this. I feel that noise makes it harder to hear the internal dialogue between the owner and his or her belongings. Listening to the TV is, of course, out of the question. If you need some background noise to relax, choose environmental or ambient music with no lyrics or well-defined melodies. If you want to add momentum to your tidying work, tap the power of the atmosphere in your room rather than relying on music. The best time to start is early morning. The fresh morning air keeps your mind clear and your power of discernment sharp. For this reason, most of my lessons commence in the morning. The earliest lesson I ever conducted began at 6:30, and we were able to clean at twice the usual speed. The clear, refreshed feeling gained after standing under a waterfall can be addictive. Similarly, when you finish putting your space in order, you will be overcome with the urge to do it again. And, unlike waterfall meditation, you don't have to travel long distances over hard terrain to get there. You can enjoy the same effect in your own home. That's pretty special, don't you think? What to do when you can't throw something away. My criterion for deciding to keep an item is that we should feel a thrill of joy when we touch it. But it is human nature to resist throwing something away, even when we know that we should. Items that we can't bring ourselves to discard, even when they don't inspire joy, are a real problem. Human judgment can be divided into two broad types, intuitive and rational. When it comes to selecting what to discard, it is actually our rational judgment that causes trouble. Although intuitively we know that an object has no attraction for us, our reason raises all kinds of arguments for not discarding it, such as, I might need it later, or it's a waste to get rid of it. These thoughts spin round and round in our mind, making it impossible to let go. I am not claiming that it is wrong to hesitate. The inability to decide demonstrates a certain degree of attachment to a particular object. Nor can all decisions be made on intuition alone. But this is precisely why we need to consider each object with care and not be distracted by thoughts of being wasteful. When you come across something that's hard to discard, consider carefully why you have that specific item in the first place. When did you get it, and what meaning did it have for you then? Reassess the role it plays in your life. If, for example, you have some clothes that you bought but never wear, examine them one at a time. Where did you buy that particular outfit and why? If you bought it because you thought it looked cool in the shop, it has fulfilled the function of giving you a thrill when you bought it. Then why did you never wear it? Was it because you realized that it didn't suit you when you tried it on at home? If so, and if you no longer buy clothes of the same style or color, it has fulfilled another important function. It has taught you what doesn't suit you. In fact, that particular article of clothing has already completed its role in your life, and you are free to say, "Thank you for giving me joy when I bought you," or, "Thank you for teaching me what doesn't suit me," and let it go. Every object has a different role to play. Not all clothes have come to you to be worn threadbare. It is the same with people. Not every person you meet in life will become a close friend or lover. Some you will find hard to get along with or impossible to like. But these people, too, teach you the precious lesson of who you do like, so that you will appreciate those special people even more. When you come across something that you cannot part with, think carefully about its true purpose in your life. You'll be surprised at how many of the things you possess have already fulfilled their role. By acknowledging their contribution and letting them go with gratitude, you will be able to truly put the things you own, and your life, in order. In the end, all that will remain are the things that you really treasure. To truly cherish the things that are important to you, you must first discard those that have outlived their purpose. To get rid of what you no longer need is neither wasteful nor shameful. Can you truthfully say that you treasure something buried so deeply in a closet or drawer that you have forgotten its existence? If things had feelings, they would certainly not be happy. Free them from the prison to which you have relegated them. Help them leave that deserted isle to which you have exiled them. Let them go, with gratitude. Not only you, but your things as well, will feel clear and refreshed when you are done tidying. 3. Tidying by category works like magic. Tidying order. Follow the correct order of categories. The door opens with a click, and a woman looks at me somewhat anxiously.
Hello.
My clients almost always seem a bit tense the first time I visit their home. As they have already met me several times, this tenseness stems not from shyness, but more from the need to brace themselves for a major challenge.
Do you think it's really possible to clean up my house? There's no place to even put your feet in here.
I don't see how I can really tidy completely in such a short time. You said that none of your clients have ever suffered rebound. But what if I'm the first? Their nervous excitement is almost palpable, but I know without a doubt that every one of them will do fine. Even those who are lazy or messy by nature, even people who have descended from generations of slobs or who are excessively busy, can learn to clean properly if they use the KonMari method. Let me share a secret. Putting your house in order is fun! The process of assessing how you feel about the things you own, identifying those that have fulfilled their purpose, expressing your gratitude, and bidding them farewell, is really about examining your inner self, a rite of passage to a new life. The yardstick by which you judge is your intuitive sense of attraction, and therefore there's no need for complex theories or numerical data. All you need to do is follow the right order. So arm yourself with plenty of garbage bags and prepare to have fun. Start with clothes, then move on to books, papers, kimono, miscellany, and finally things with sentimental value. If you reduce what you own in this order, your work will proceed with surprising ease. By starting with the easy things first and leaving the hardest for last, you can gradually hone your decision-making skills, so that by the end, it seems simple. For the first category, clothing, I recommend dividing further into the following subcategories to increase efficiency. Tops, shirts, sweaters, etc. Bottoms, pants, skirts, etc. Clothes that should be hung, jackets, coats, suits, etc. Socks, underwear. Bags, handbags, messenger bags, etc. Accessories, scarves, belts, hats, etc. Clothes for specific events, swimsuits, kimonos, uniforms, etc. Shoes. And yes, I include handbags and shoes as clothing. Why is this the optimal order? I am actually not sure why, but based on the experience I've gained devoting half my life to tidying, I can tell you for certain that it works. Believe me, if you follow this order, you'll speed through the work and achieve visible results surprisingly quickly. Moreover, because you will keep only the things you truly love, your energy and joy will increase. You may be physically tired, but it feels so good to get rid of unnecessary items that you will find it hard to stop. The important point, however, is deciding what to keep. What things will bring you joy if you keep them as part of your life? Pick them as if you were identifying items you loved from a showcase in your favorite store. Once you've grasped the basics, put all your clothes in one heap, take them in your hand one by one, and ask yourself quietly, does this spark joy? Your tidying festival has begun. Clothing. Place every item of clothing in the house on the floor. The first step is to check every closet and dresser in the house and gather all your clothes in one spot. Don't leave a single wardrobe or dresser drawer unopened. Make sure you have gathered every last piece of clothing. When my clients think they have finished, I always ask them this question. Are you sure there's not a single piece of clothing left in the house? Then I add, you can forget about any clothes you find after this. They'll automatically go in the discard pile. I let them know I'm quite serious. I have no intention of letting them keep anything found after the sorting is done. The response is usually, oh, wait, I think there might be something in my husband's closet. Or, ah, I might have hung something in the hallway. Followed by one last dash around the house and a few extra items added to the pile. This ultimatum sounds a bit like the automatic withdrawal system for paying bills at the bank, but when my clients know there's a firm deadline, they search their memories one more time because they don't want to lose clothes without being given a chance to decide. Although I rarely have to follow through on my threat, if someone doesn't remember an item at this point, it obviously doesn't inspire a thrill of joy, and therefore I am quite ruthless. The only exception is clothes that happen to be in the laundry. When all the clothes have been gathered together, the pile of tops alone is usually knee-deep. The term tops includes clothes for every season, from t-shirts and camisoles to knitted sweaters. The average number of items in this initial pile is around 160. Confronted by their first obstacle in the tidying process, most people are overwhelmed by the sheer volume of what they actually own. At this point, I usually say, let's start with off-season clothes. I have a good reason for choosing off-season clothing for their first foray into this tidying gala. It's the easiest category for tuning into one's intuition concerning what feels good. If they start with clothes they are currently using, clients are more likely to think, it doesn't spark joy, but I just wore it yesterday. Or, if I don't have any clothes left to wear, what am I going to do? This makes it harder for them to make an objective decision. Because off-season clothes are not imminently necessary, it is much easier to apply the simple criterion of whether or not they bring you joy. There's one question I recommend asking when you select off-season clothes. Do I want to see this outfit again next time it's in season? Or, to rephrase it, would I want to wear this right away if the temperature suddenly changed? Do I want to see it again? Well, not necessarily. If that's how you feel, throw it in the discard or donate pile. And if you got a lot of wear out of it last season, don't forget to express your appreciation. You might fear that you'll have no clothes left if you use this standard, but don't worry. It may seem as if you have discarded an awful lot, but as long as you are choosing clothes that give you pleasure, you'll be left with the amount you need. Once you have gotten the knack of choosing what you love, you can move on to each subcategory of in-season clothing. The most important points to remember are these. Make sure you gather every piece of clothing in the house, and be sure to handle each one. Loungewear. Downgrading to loungewear is taboo. It seems a waste to get rid of something that is still perfectly usable, especially if you bought it yourself. In cases like this, my clients often ask me if they can keep clothes they know they'll never wear outside and use them as loungewear. If I said yes, the pile of loungewear would grow ever larger without any decrease in the overall volume of clothes. Having said that, I admit that I myself once did the same thing with clothes I knew I'd never wear to go out. Pilled cardigans, outdated blouses, dresses that didn't suit me or that I just never wore. It wasn't long before I had developed the habit of demoting clothes like these to loungewear, rather than discarding them. Yet 9 out of 10 times, I never wore them. I soon discovered that many of my clients also had collections of dormant loungewear. When asked why they don't wear them, their answers are very revealing. I can't relax in them. It seems a waste to wear this inside when it was really for going out. I don't like it. And so on. In other words, these cast-offs are not really loungewear at all. Calling them that merely delays parting with clothes that don't spark any joy. There are stores dedicated solely to loungewear products, and the design, material, and cut are all aimed at relaxation. Obviously, it is a completely different genre from what we wear outside. Cotton t-shirts are probably the only type of regular clothing that could be reused in this category. To me, it doesn't seem right to keep clothes we don't enjoy for relaxing around the house. This time at home is still a precious part of living. Its value should not change just because nobody sees us. So, starting today, break the habit of downgrading clothes that don't thrill you to loungewear. The real waste is not discarding clothes you don't like, but wearing them even though you are striving to create the ideal space for your ideal lifestyle. Precisely because no one is there to see you, it makes far more sense to reinforce a positive self-image by wearing clothes you love. The same goes for pajamas. If you are a woman, try wearing something elegant as nightwear. The worst thing you can do is to wear a sloppy sweatsuit. I occasionally meet people who dress like this all the time, whether waking or sleeping. If sweatpants are your everyday attire, you'll end up looking like you belong in them, which is not very attractive. What you wear in the house does impact your self-image. Clothing storage. Fold it right and solve your storage problems. After the selection process, my clients are usually left with only a third to a quarter of the clothes they started out with. As the clothes they want to keep are still piled in the middle of the floor, it is time to start putting them away. Before I go on to that step, however, let me tell you a story. I once had a client with a problem that I just could not understand. A woman in her 50s, she told me during our initial interview that she didn't have enough closet space in her house for all her clothes. From the floor plan, however, it was clear not only that she had two full closets to herself, but that those closets were 1.5 times larger than average. Although this should have been plenty of space, she also had a clothing stand with 3 rods full of clothes. Amazed, I roughly estimated that she must have more than 2,000 outfits in her wardrobe. It was only when I visited her home that I finally understood. Upon opening her wall-length closet, my jaw dropped. It was like looking at the crowded racks at the dry cleaners. Hanging neatly on hangers were not just coats and skirts, but also t-shirts, sweaters, purses, and even underwear. My client immediately launched into a detailed explanation of her hanger collection. "This type is made especially for knit so that they don't slip off, and these are handmade. I bought them in Germany." After a 5-minute lecture, she beamed at me and said, "Clothes don't get wrinkled if you hang them up, and they last longer too, right?" Upon further questioning, I discovered that she did not fold any of her clothes at all. There are 2 storage methods for clothes. One is to put them on hangers and hang from a rod, and the other is to fold them and put them away in drawers. I can understand why people might be attracted to hanging their clothes. It seems like far less work. However, I strongly recommend folding as the main storage method. "But it's a pain to fold clothes and put them away in the drawer. It's much easier to pop them on a hanger and stick them in the closet." If that's what you're thinking, then you haven't discovered the true impact of folding. Hanging just can't compete with folding for saving space. Although it depends somewhat on the thickness of the clothes in question, you can fit from 20 to 40 pieces of folded clothing in the same amount of space required to hang 10. The client had only slightly more clothes than average. If she had folded them, she would have had no problem fitting them into her storage space. By neatly folding your clothes, you can solve almost every problem related to storage. But that is not the only effect of folding. The real benefit is that you must handle each piece of clothing. As you run your hands over the cloth, you pour your energy into it. The Japanese word for healing is teate, which literally means to apply hands. The term originated prior to the development of modern medicine, when people believed that placing one's hand on an injury promoted healing. We know that gentle physical contact from a parent, such as holding hands, patting a child on the head, and hugging, has a calming effect on children. Likewise, a firm but gentle massage by human hands does much more to loosen knotted muscles than being pummeled by a massage machine. The energy that flows from the person's hands into our skin seems to heal both body and soul. The same is true for clothing. When we take our clothes in our hands and fold them neatly, we are, I believe, transmitting energy, which has a positive effect on our clothes. Folding properly pulls the cloth taut and erases wrinkles, and makes the material stronger and more vibrant. Clothes that have been neatly folded have a resilience and sheen that can be discerned immediately, clearly distinguishing them from those that have been haphazardly stuffed in a drawer. The act of folding is far more than making clothes compact for storage. It is an act of caring, an expression of love and appreciation for the way these clothes support your lifestyle. Therefore, when we fold, we should put our heart into it, thanking our clothes for protecting our bodies. In addition, folding clothes after they have been washed and dried is an opportunity to really notice them in all their detail. For example, we might spot places where the cloth has frayed or see that a certain piece of clothing is becoming worn out. Folding is really a form of dialogue with our wardrobe. Japanese traditional clothing, kimono and yukata, were always folded into rectangles to fit perfectly into drawers designed to their uniform dimensions. I don't think there is any other culture in the world where storage units and clothing were matched so precisely. Japanese people quickly grasp the pleasure that comes from folding clothes, almost as if they are genetically programmed for this task. How to fold. The best way to fold for perfect appearance. The laundry is done and ready to be put away. But this is where many people get stuck. Folding seems like extra work, especially as the clothes will be worn again soon anyway. Many people can't be bothered, and soon they have a heap of clothes on the floor. They fall into the daily routine of picking something out of the pile to wear while the mound continues to grow, eventually spreading from one corner to take over the rest of the room. If this describes you, don't worry. None of my clients have ever known how to fold clothes properly when they began taking my lessons. In fact, quite a few of them declared that it was their policy never to fold their clothes. I have opened closets so full that the clothes looked like they had been hardened in a jelly mold, and I have witnessed drawers filled with clothes rolled and twisted like noodles. You would think my clients had never seen the first letter of the word fold, but once they finish my course, all of them, without exception, have told me, "Folding is fun!" One of my clients, a young woman in her 20s, hated folding so much that her mother used to come and do it for her. Through the course, however, she came to love it, and even taught her mother how to fold properly. Once you have mastered this technique, you will actually enjoy doing it every day, and will find it a handy skill for the rest of your life. In fact, to go through life without knowing how to fold is a huge loss. The first step is to visualize what the inside of your drawer will look like when you finish. The goal should be to organize the content so that you can see where every item is at a glance, just as you can see the spines of the books on your bookshelves. The key is to store things standing up rather than laid flat. Some people mimic store displays, folding each piece of clothing into a large square and then arranging them one on top of the other in layers. This is great for temporary sales displays in stores, but not what we should be aiming for at home, where our relationship with these clothes is long-term. To store clothes standing, they must be made compact, which means more folds. Some people believe that more folds means more wrinkles, but that is not the case. It is not the number of folds, but rather the amount of pressure applied that causes wrinkling. Even lightly folded clothes will wrinkle if they are stored in a pile, because the weight of the clothes acts like a press. Think of the difference between folding one sheet of paper as opposed to 100 sheets in one go. It is much harder to get a sharp crease when folding a whole stack of paper at one time. Once you have an image of what the inside of your drawers will look like, you can begin folding. The goal is to fold each piece of clothing into a simple, smooth rectangle. First, fold each lengthwise side of the garment toward the center, such as the left hand, then right hand, sides of a shirt, and tuck the sleeves in to make a long rectangular shape. It doesn't matter how you fold the sleeves. Next, pick up one short end of the rectangle and fold it toward the other short end. Then fold again, in the same manner, in halves or in thirds. The number of folds should be adjusted so that the folded clothing, when standing on edge, fits the height of the drawer. This is the basic principle that will ultimately allow your clothes to be stacked on edge, side by side, so that when you pull open your drawer, you can see the edge of every item inside. If you find that the end result is the right shape but too loose and floppy to stand up, it's a sign that your way of folding doesn't match the type of clothing. Every piece of clothing has its own sweet spot, where it feels just right, a folded state that best suits that item. This will differ depending on the type of material and size of the clothing, and therefore you will need to adjust your method until you find what works. This isn't difficult. By adjusting the height when folded so that it stands properly, you'll reach the sweet spot surprisingly easily. Folding goes even more smoothly if you fold thin, soft material more tightly, reducing it to a small width and height, and thick, fluffy materials less. In cases where one end of the piece of clothing is thicker than the other, it also helps to keep the thinner end in your hand while folding. There is nothing more satisfying than finding that sweet spot. The piece of clothing keeps its shape when stood on edge and feels just right when held in your hand. It's like a sudden revelation. So this is how you always wanted to be folded. A historical moment in which your mind and the piece of clothing connect. I love the way my clients' faces light up at that moment. Arranging clothes. The secret to energizing your closet. It feels great to open up your closet and see the clothes you love arranged neatly on hangers. But my clients' closets are often such a mess that it takes courage just to open them, and, once open, it's impossible to find anything in them. There are two possible causes. The first is that the closet is simply too full. One of my clients had jammed so many clothes inside that it took her 3 full minutes to extract a single outfit. The hangers were so closely packed that when, after much grunting and pulling, she finally managed to extract an outfit, the clothes on either side popped out with it like bread from a toaster. I could see why she had not used that closet for several years. This is an extreme example, but it is true that most people store far more than necessary in their closets. This is one reason I recommend folding whatever clothes you can. Of course, there are some types of clothing that are better stored on hangers. These include coats, suits, jackets, skirts, and dresses. My standard is this. Hang any clothes that look like they would be happier hung up, such as those made with soft materials that flutter in the breeze or highly tailored cuts, which protest at being folded. These we should hang willingly. The other cause of a messy closet is lack of knowledge. Many people simply don't know how to organize clothes on hangers. The most basic rule is to hang clothes in the same category side by side, dividing your closet into a jacket section, a suit section, and so on. Clothes, like people, can relax more freely when in the company of others who are very similar in type, and therefore organizing them by category helps them feel more comfortable and secure. You can literally transform your closet just by applying this principle. Of course, many people insist that even when they organize their clothes by category, it isn't long before their closets are messy again. So let me introduce a secret for maintaining the neatness of closets that you work hard to organize. Arrange your clothes so that they rise to the right. Take a moment to draw an arrow rising toward the right, and then another descending to the right. You can do this on paper or just trace them in the air. Did you notice that when you draw an arrow rising to the right, it makes you feel lighter? Lines that slope up to the right make people feel comfortable. By using this principle when you organize your closet, you can make the contents look far more exciting. To do so, hang heavy items on the left side of the closet and light items on the right. Heavy items include those with length, those made from heavier material, and those that are dark in color. As you move toward the right side of the closet, the length of the clothing grows shorter, the material thinner, and the color lighter. By category, coats would be on the far left, followed by dresses, jackets, pants, skirts, and blouses. This is the basic order, but depending on the trends in your wardrobe, what classifies as heavy in each category will differ. Use your intuition to create a balance that makes it appear as if the clothes are sloping up to the right. In addition, organize the clothes within each category from heavy to light. When you stand in front of a closet that has been reorganized so that the clothes rise to the right, you will feel your heart beat faster and the cells in your body buzz with energy. This energy will also be transmitted to your clothes. Even when you close the closet door, your room will feel fresher. Once you have experienced this, you'll never lose the habit of organizing by category. Some may question whether paying attention to such details can possibly cause such a change, but why waste your time doubting if incorporating this exciting magic into all your storage spaces could keep your room tidy? It will only take you 10 minutes to rearrange your closet by category, so trust me and give it a try. But don't forget that you first need to reduce your wardrobe to only those clothes that you really love. Storing socks. Treat your socks and stockings with respect. Have you ever had the experience where you thought that what you were doing was a good thing but later learned that it had hurt someone? At the time, you were totally unconcerned, oblivious to the other person's feelings. This is somewhat similar to the way many of us treat our socks. I visited the home of a client in her 50s. As always, we started with her clothes. We moved through her wardrobe at a smooth pace, finished the underwear, and were ready to start organizing her socks. But when she pulled open her sock drawer, I could not suppress a gasp. It was full of potato-like lumps that rolled about. She had folded back the tops to form balls and tied her stockings tightly in the middle. I was speechless. Dressed in a crisp white apron, my client smiled at me and said, "It's easy to pick out what I need this way, and it's quite simple to put them away as well, don't you think?" Although I frequently run into this attitude during my lessons, it never fails to astonish me. Let me state, here and now, never, ever tie up your stockings. Never, ever ball up your socks. I pointed to the balled up socks. Look at them carefully. This should be a time for them to rest. Do you really think they can get any rest like that? That's right. The socks and stockings stored in your drawer are essentially on holiday. They take a brutal beating in their daily work, trapped between your foot and your shoe, enduring pressure and friction to protect your precious feet. The time they spend in your drawer is their only chance to rest. But if they are folded over, balled up, or tied, they are always in a state of tension, their fabric stretched and their elastic pulled. They roll about and bump into each other every time the drawer is opened and closed. Any socks and stockings unfortunate enough to get pushed to the back of the drawer are often forgotten for so long that their elastic stretches beyond recovery. When the owner finally discovers them and puts them on, it will be too late and they will be relegated to the garbage. What treatment could be worse than this? Let's begin with how to fold your stockings. If you've tied them up, start by undoing the knot. Lay the toes one on top of the other and fold the stocking in half lengthwise. Then fold it into thirds, making sure that the toes are inside, not outside, and that the waistband protrudes slightly at the top. Finally, roll the stocking up toward the waistband. If the waistband is on the outside when you finish, you've done it right. Fold knee-high stockings the same way. With thicker material, such as tights, it is easier to roll if you fold them in half rather than in thirds. The point is that the stocking should be firm and stable when you've finished, much like a sushi roll. When you store the stockings in your drawer, arrange them on end so that the swirl is visible. If you are storing them in plastic drawers, I recommend putting them into a cardboard box first, so that they don't slip and unroll, and putting the box into the drawer. A shoebox is the perfect size for a stocking divider. This method is a win-win solution. It allows you to see how many stockings you have at a single glance, protects your stockings from damage, and keeps them smooth and unwrinkled so that they are easier to put on. And it makes your stockings much happier, too. Folding socks is even easier. If you've folded back the tops, start by unfolding them. Place one sock on top of the other and follow the same principles as those for folding clothing. For low-cut socks that cover just the feet, folding twice is enough. For ankle socks, 3 times. For knee socks and over-knee socks, 4 to 6 times. You can adjust the number of folds to achieve the height that best suits the drawer. It's easy. Just aim to make a simple rectangle, the key to folding. Store the socks on edge, just as you did for clothing. You'll be amazed at how little space you need compared to your potato ball days, and you'll notice your socks breathing a sigh of relief at being untied. When I see high school students wearing high socks that are loose at the top, I long to tell them how to fold their socks properly. Seasonal clothes. Eliminate the need to store off-season clothes. June in Japan is the rainy season. It is also traditionally the month for koromagae, when people change to summer clothes. This is preceded by several weeks of cleaning and packing away winter clothes and bringing out summer clothes. Whenever this time of year approaches, it reminds me that I used to do this too. For years, however, I have not bothered to put away off-season clothes. The custom of koromagae originated in China and was introduced to Japan as a court custom during the Heian period, 794 to 1185 AD. It was only in the late 19th century, when workers and students began to wear uniforms, that the custom was introduced in businesses and schools. Companies and schools officially switched to the summer uniform at the beginning of June, and to the winter uniform at the beginning of October. In other words, this rule was only applied within organizations, and its extension to the ordinary home was not really necessary. But like every other Japanese, I, too, was convinced that I had to store and unpack seasonal clothing twice a year, in June and October. I spent these 2 months busily emptying and refilling the contents of closets and drawers. To be honest, I found this custom a nuisance. If a dress I wanted to wear was stored away in a box on the top shelf of the closet, it seemed like far too much trouble to get it down and dig it out. Instead, I would compromise and wear something else. There were some years when I didn't manage to unpack my summer clothes until July, and I would realize that in the meantime I had bought clothes similar to those I already owned. Often, as soon as I got out my summer clothes, the weather would suddenly turn cold again. The custom of storing seasonal clothes is behind the times. With the introduction of air conditioning and heating, our homes are less subject to the weather outside. It's not uncommon now to see people wearing t-shirts indoors, even in winter. So it's time to abandon this custom and keep all our clothes ready to be used year-round, regardless of the season. My clients love this approach, especially because they can grasp at all times exactly what clothes they have. No difficult techniques are required. All you need to do is organize your clothes on the premise that you aren't going to put off-season clothes in storage. The trick is not to over-categorize. Divide your clothes roughly into cotton-like and wool-like materials when you put them in the drawer. Categorizing by season, summer, winter, fall, and spring, or by activity, such as work and leisure, should be avoided because it is too vague. If my client's space is limited, I have them store only small, specific off-season items, such as bathing suits and sun hats for the summer season, and mufflers, mittens, and earmuffs for the winter season. Although not a small item, winter coats can also be put away in the back of the closet during the off-season. For those of you who still don't have enough space, let me share a few tips for storing your off-season clothes. Many people store their off-season clothes in plastic cases with lids. These, however, are the hardest type of storage units to use effectively. Once in the closet, something is bound to be placed on top of it, and pulling the case out and opening it up seems like too much extra work. In the end, it is all too easy to forget the case is even there until the season is almost over. If you are planning to buy storage units in the near future, I recommend that you get a set of drawers instead. Be careful not to bury clothes in the cupboard, even if they are off-season. Clothes that have been shut up for half a year look wilted, as if they have been stifled. Instead, Let in some light and air occasionally. Open the drawer and run your hands over the contents. Let them know you care and look forward to wearing them when they are next in season. This kind of communication helps your clothes stay vibrant